for a while, Al said. Think of a city or a town at random. One that none of us have anything to do with. One where none of us ever go or have ever gone.
Baltimore, Joe said.
Okay. I'm going to Baltimore. I'm going to see if a store picked at random will accept Runciter currency.
Buy me some new cigarettes, Joe said.
Okay, I'll do that too. I'll see if cigarettes in a random store in Baltimore have been affected. I'll check other products as well. I'll make random samplings. Do you want to come with me, or do you want to go upstairs and tell them about Wendy?
Joe said,
I'll go with you. Maybe we should never tell them about her.
I think we should, Joe said, since it's going to happen again. It may happen before we get back. It may be happening now.
Then we better get our trip to Baltimore over as quickly as possible,
Al said. He started out of the office. Joe Chip followed. 9.
My hair is so dry, so unmanageable. What's a girl to do? Simply rub in creamy Ubik hair conditioner. In just 5 days, you'll discover new body in your hair, new glossiness. And Ubik hairspray, used as directed, is absolutely safe.
They selected the Lucky People supermarket on the periphery of Baltimore. At the counter, Al said to the autonomic computerized checker,
Give me a pack of Pall Malls.
Wings are cheaper, Joe said. Irritated, Al said,
They don't make wings anymore. They haven't for years.
They make them, Joe said, but they don't advertise. It's an honest cigarette that claims nothing. To the checker, he said, Change that from Pall Malls to wings. The pack of cigarettes slid from the chute and onto the counter.
95 cents,
the checker said.
Here's a 10 Poscrep bill.
Al fed the bill to the checker, whose circuits at once whirred as it scrutinized the bill.
Your change, sir,
the checker said. It deposited a neat heap of coins and bills before Al.
Please, move along now.
So, Runciter money is acceptable,
Al said to himself as he and Joe got out of the way of the next customer, a heavy-set old lady wearing a blueberry-colored cloth coat and carrying a Mexican rope shopping bag. Cautiously, he opened the pack of cigarettes. The cigarettes crumbled between his fingers.
It would have proved something, Al said, if this had been a pack of Pall Malls. I'm getting back in line.
He started to do so, and then discovered that the heavy-set old lady in the dark coat was arguing violently with the autonomic checker.
It was dead,
she asserted shrilly.
By the time I got it home, here, you can have it back.
She set a pot on the counter. It contained, Al saw, a lifeless plant, perhaps an azalea. In its moribund state, it showed few features.
I can't give you a refund,
the checker answered.
No warranty goes with the plant life which we sell. Buyer beware is our rule. Please, move along now.
And the Saturday Evening Post,
the old lady said,
that I picked up from your newsstand, it was over a year old. What's the matter with you? And the Martian Grubworm TV dinner?
Next customer,
the checker said. It ignored her. Al got out of line. He roamed about the premises until he came to the cartons of cigarettes, every conceivable brand stacked to heights of 8 feet or more.
Pick a carton, he said to Joe.
Domino's, Joe said. They're the same price as wings.
Christ, don't pick an off-brand. Pick something like Winston's or Kool's.
He himself yanked out a carton.
It's empty.
He shook it.
I can tell by the weight.
Something, however, inside the carton bounced about, something weightless and small. He tore the carton open and looked within it. A scrawled note, in handwriting familiar to him and to Joe. He lifted it out, and together they both read it. Essential, I get in touch with you. Situation serious, and certainly will get more so as time goes on. There are several possible explanations, which I'll discuss with you. Anyhow, don't give up. I'm sorry about Wendy Wright. In that connection, we did all we could. Al said,
So he knows about Wendy. Well, maybe that means it won't happen again to the rest of us.
A random carton of cigarettes,
Joe said,
at a random store in a city picked at random. And we find a note directed at us from Glenn Runciter. What do the other cartons have in them? The same note?
He lifted down a carton of L&M's, shook it, then opened it. 10 packs of cigarettes, plus 10 more below them. Absolutely normal.
Or is it?
Al asked himself. He lifted out one of the packs.
You can see they're okay, Joe said.
He pulled out a carton from the middle of the stacks.
This one is full, too.
He did not open it. Instead, he reached for another, and then another. All had packs of cigarettes in them. And all crumbled into fragments between Al's fingers.
I wonder how he knew we'd come here,
Al said.
And how he knew we'd try that one particular carton.
It made no sense, and yet, here, too, the pair of opposing forces were at work.
Decay versus Runciter,
Al said to himself.
Throughout the world, perhaps throughout the universe. Maybe the sun will go out,
Al conjectured.
And Glenn Runciter will place a substitute sun in its place, if he can. Yes,
he thought.
That's the question. How much can Runciter do?
Put another way, how far can the process of decay go?
Let's try something else,
Al said. He walked along the aisle, past cans, packages, and boxes, coming at last to the appliance center of the store. There, on impulse, he picked up an expensive German-made tape recorder.
This looks all right,
he said to Joe, who had followed him. He picked up a second one, still in its container.
Let's buy this and take it back to New York with us.
Don't you want to open it? Joe said. And try it out before you buy it?
I think I already know what we'll find,
Al said.
And it's something we can't test out here.
He carried the tape recorder toward the check stand. Back in New York, at Runciter Associates, they turned the tape recorder over to the firm's shop. 15 minutes later, the shop foreman, having taken apart the mechanism, made his report.
All the moving parts in the tape transport stage are worn. The rubber drive tire has flat spots on it. Pieces of rubber are all over the insides. The brakes for high-speed wind and rewind are virtually gone. It needs cleaning and lubricating throughout. It's seen plenty of use. In fact, I would say it needs a complete overhaul, including new belts.
Al said,
Several years of use?
Possibly. How long you had it?
I bought it today, Al said.
That is impossible,
the shop foreman said.
Or if you did, they sold you.
I know what they sold me, Al said. I knew when I got it, before I opened the carton.
To Joe, he said,
A brand new tape recorder, completely worn out. Bought with funny money that the store is willing to accept. Worthless money, worthless article purchased. It has a sort of logic to it.
This is not my day,
the shop foreman said.
This morning when I got up, my parrot was dead.
Dead of what? Joe asked.
I don't know, just dead. Stiff as a board.
The shop foreman waggled a bony finger at Al.
I'll tell you something you don't know about your tape recorder. It isn't just worn out. It's 40 years obsolete. They don't use rubber drive tires anymore, or belt-run transports. You'll never get parts for it unless somebody hand-makes them. And it wouldn't be worth it. The damn thing is antiquated. Junk it. Forget about it.
You're right, Al said. I didn't know.
He accompanied Joe out of the shop and into the corridor.
Now we're talking about something other than decay. This is a different matter. And we're gonna have trouble finding edible food, anywhere of any kind. How much of the food sold in supermarkets would be good after that many years?
The canned goods, Joe said. And I saw a lot of canned goods at that supermarket in Baltimore.
And now we know why, Al said. 40 years ago, supermarkets sold a far greater proportion of their commodities in cans rather than frozen. That may turn out to be our sole source. You're right.
He cogitated.
But in one day, it's jumped from 2 years to 40 years. By this time tomorrow, it may be 100 years. And no food is edible 100 years after it's packaged, cans or otherwise.
Chinese eggs, Joe said. 1,000-year-old eggs that they bury in the ground.
And it's not just us, Al said. That old woman in Baltimore. It's affecting what she bought, too. Her azalea. Is the whole world gonna starve because of a bomb blast on Luna? He asked himself. Why is everyone involved instead of just us?
Joe said,
Here comes. Be quiet a second, Al said. I have to think something out. Maybe Baltimore is only there when one of us goes there, and the Lucky People supermarket. As soon as we left, it passed out of existence. It could still be that only we who were on Luna are really experiencing this.
A philosophical problem of no importance or meaning, Joe said, and incapable of being proved one way or the other. Al said caustically,
It would be important to that old lady in the blueberry-colored cloth coat and all the rest of them.
Here's the shop foreman, Joe said.
I've just been looking at the instruction manual,
the shop foreman said.
That came with your tape recorder?
He held the booklet out to Al, a complicated expression on his face.
Take a look.
All at once, he grabbed it back.
I saved the trouble reading. Look here on the last page where it tells who made the damn thing and where to send it for factory repairs.
Made by Runciter of Zurich, Al read aloud. And a maintenance station in the North American Confederation, in Des Moines. The same as on the match folder.
He passed the booklet to Joe and said,
We're going to Des Moines. This booklet is the first manifestation that links the two locations. I wonder why Des Moines,
he said to himself. Can you recall, he said to Joe,
any connection that Runciter ever had during his lifetime with Des Moines?
Joe said, Runciter was born there. He spent his first 15 years there. Every once in a while, he used to mention it.
So now, after his death, he's gone back there. In some manner or other. Runciter is in Zurich, he thought, and also in Des Moines. In Zurich, he has measurable brain metabolism. His physical half-life body is suspended in cold pack in the beloved Brethren Moratorium, and yet he can't be reached. In Des Moines, he has no physical existence, and yet, evidently, there contact can be established. In fact, by such extensions as this instruction booklet has been established, at least in one direction, from him to us. And meanwhile,
he thought,
our world declines, turns back onto itself, bringing to the surface past phases of reality. By the end of the week, we may wake up and find ancient clanging streetcars moving down Fifth Avenue. Trolley dodgers,
he thought, and wondered what that meant. An abandoned verbal term rising from the past, a hazy, distant emanation in his mind, canceling out current reality. Even this indistinct perception, still only subjective, made him uneasy. It had already become too real, an entity which he had never known about before this moment.
Trolley dodgers,
he said aloud. 100 years ago at least, obsessively, the term remained lodged within awareness. He could not forget it.
How come you know that?
The shop foreman asked.
Nobody knows that anymore. That's the old name for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
He eyed Al suspiciously. Joe said,
We better go upstairs and make sure they're all right before we take off for Des Moines. If we don't get to Des Moines soon, Al said, It may turn out to be an all-day trip, or even a two-day trip. As methods of transportation devolve, he thought, from rocket propulsion to jet, from jet to piston-driven aircraft, then surface travel as the coal-fed steam train, horse-drawn cart. But it couldn't regress that far, he said to himself. And yet we've already got on our hands a 40-year-old tape recorder, run by rubber drive tire and belts. Maybe it could really be.
He and Joe walked rapidly to the elevator. Joe pressed the button, and they waited, both of them on edge, saying nothing. Both withdrew into their own thoughts. The elevator arrived clatteringly. The racket awoke Al from his introspection. Reflexively, he pushed aside the iron grill safety door and found himself facing an open cage with polished brass fittings suspended from a cable. A dull-eyed, uniformed operator sat on a stool, working the handle. He gazed at them with indifference. It was not indifference, however, that Al felt.
"Don't get in," he said to Joe, holding him back. "Look at it and think. Try to remember the elevator we rode in earlier today. The hydraulic-powered, closed, self-operated, absolutely silent."
He ceased talking, because the elderly clanking contraption had dimmed, and in its place, the familiar elevator resumed its existence. And yet he sensed the presence of the other, older elevator. It lurked at the periphery of his vision, as if ready to ebb forward as soon as he and Joe turned their attention away.
"It wants to come back," he realized. "It intends to come back. We can delay it temporarily. A few hours, probably, at the most. The momentum of the retrograde force is increasing. Archaic forms are moving toward domination more rapidly than we thought. It's now a question of 100 years at one swing. The elevator we just now saw must have been a century old. And yet," he thought, "we seem able to exert some control over it. We did force the actual contemporary elevator back into being. If all of us stay together, if we function as an entity of not 2, but 12 minds. "What did you see?" Joe was saying to him. "It made you tell me not to get in the elevator," Al said. "Didn't you see the old elevator? Open cage, brass, from around 1910, with the operator sitting on his stool?"
"No," Joe said.
"Did you see anything?"
"This," Joe gestured. "The normal elevator I see every day when I come to work. I saw what I always see, what I see now." He entered the elevator, turned, and stood facing Al.
"Then, our perceptions are beginning to differ," Al realized.
He wondered what that meant. It seemed ominous. He did not like it at all. In its dire, obscure way, it seemed to him potentially the most deadly change since Runciter's death. They were no longer regressing at the same rate, and he had an acute, intuitive intimation that Wendy Wright had experienced exactly this before her death. He wondered how much time he himself had left. Now he became aware of an insidious, seeping, cooling off, which at some earlier and unremembered time had begun to explore him, investigating him as well as the world around him. It reminded him of their final minutes on Luna. The chill debased the surfaces of objects. It warped, expanded, showed itself as bulb-like swellings that sighed audibly and popped. Into the manifold open wounds, the cold drifted, all the way down into the heart of things, the core which made them live. What he saw now seemed to be a desert of ice from which stark boulders jutted. A wind spewed across the plain which reality had become. The wind congealed into deeper ice, and the boulders disappeared for the most part, and darkness presented itself off at the edges of his vision. He caught only a meager glimpse of it.
"But," he thought, "this is projection on my part. It isn't the universe which is being entombed by layers of wind, cold, darkness, and ice. All this is going on within me, and yet I seem to see it outside. Strange, he thought. Is the whole world inside me, engulfed by my body? When did that happen? It must be a manifestation of dying, he said to himself. The uncertainty which I feel, the slowing down into entropy, that's the process, and the ice which I see is the result of the success of the process. When I blink out, he thought, the whole universe will disappear. But what about the various lights which I should see, the entrances to new wombs? Where in particular is the red, smoky light of fornicating couples? And the dull, dark lights signifying animal greed. All I can make out, he thought, is encroaching darkness and utter loss of heat. A plane which is cooling off, abandoned by its sun. This can't be normal death, he said to himself. This is unnatural. The regular momentum of dissolution has been replaced by another factor imposed upon it. A pressure, arbitrary and forced. Maybe I can understand it, he thought. If I can just lie down and rest. If I can get enough energy to think.
What's the matter? Joe asked as together they ascended in the elevator.
Nothing, Al said curtly. They may make it, he thought. But I'm not going to.
He and Joe continued on up in empty silence. As he entered the conference room, Joe realized that Al was no longer with him. Turning, he looked back down the corridor. He made out Al standing alone, not coming any farther.
What's the matter?
He asked again. Al did not move.
Are you all right?
Joe asked, walking back toward him.
I feel tired,
Al said.
You don't look good,
Joe said, feeling deeply uneasy. Al said,
I'm going to the men's room. You go ahead and join the others. Make sure they're okay. I'll be along pretty soon.
He started vaguely away. He seemed now confused.
I'll be okay,
he said. He moved along the corridor haltingly, as if having difficulty seeing his way.
I'll go with you, Joe said, to make sure you get there. Maybe if I splash some warm water on my face,
Al said. He found the toll-free door to the men's room, and with Joe's help, opened it and disappeared inside. Joe remained in the corridor.
Something's the matter with them, he said to himself. Seeing the old elevator made a change in him.
He wondered why. Al reappeared.
What is it?
Joe said, seeing the expression on his face.
Take a look at this,
Al said. He led Joe into the men's room and pointed at the far wall.
Graffiti, he said. You know, words scrawled. Like you find all the time in the men's room. Read it.
In crayon, or purple ballpoint pen ink, the words read, Jump in the urinal and stand on your head. I'm the one that's alive. You're all dead.
Is it Runciter's writing?
Al asked.
Do you recognize it?
Yes, Joe said, nodding.
It's Runciter's writing. So now we know the truth,
Al said.
Is it the truth?
Al said,
Sure. Obviously. What a hell of a way to learn it. From the wall of a men's room.
He felt bitter resentment rather than anything else.
That's how graffiti is. Harsh and direct. We might have watched the TV and listened to the vidphone and read the papes for months. Forever, maybe. Without finding out. Without being told straight to the point. like this.
Joe said, but we're not dead, except for Wendy.
We're in half-life. Probably still on Pratfall 2. We're probably on our way back to Earth from Luna after the explosion that killed us. Killed us, not Runciter. And he's trying to pick up the flow of proto-phasons from us. So far, he's failed. We're not getting across from our world to his. But he's managed to reach us. We're picking him up everywhere, even places we choose at random. His presence is invading us on every side. Him, and only him. Because he's the sole person trying to...
He and only he, Joe interrupted. Instead of him, you said him.
Oh, I'm sick,
Al said. He started water running in the basin, began splashing it onto his face. It was not hot water, however, Joe saw. In the water, fragments of ice crackled and splintered.
You go back to the conference room. I'll be along when I feel better. Assuming I ever do feel better.
I think I ought to stay here with you,
Joe said.
No, God damn it, get out of here!
His face gray and filled with panic, Al shoved him toward the door of the men's room. He propelled Joe out into the corridor.
Go on! Make sure they're all right!
Al retreated back into the men's room, clutching at his own eyes. Bent over, he disappeared from view as the door swung shut. Joe hesitated.
Okay, he said. I'll be in the conference room with them.
He waited, listening, heard nothing.
Al?
He said.
Christ,
he thought.
This is terrible. Something is really the matter with them.
I want to see with my own eyes,
he said, pushing against the door,
that you're all right.
In a low, calm voice, Al said,
it's too late, Joe. Don't look.
The men's room had become dark. Al evidently had managed to turn the light off.
You can't do anything to help me,
he said in a weak but steady voice.
We shouldn't have separated from the others. That's why it happened to Wendy. You can stay alive, at least for a while, if you go find them and stick with them. Tell them that. Make sure all of them understand. Do you understand?
Joe reached for the light switch. A blow, feeble and weightless, cuffed his hand in the darkness. Terrified, he withdrew his hand, shocked by the impotence of Al's punch. It told him everything. He no longer needed to see.
I'll go join the others, he said. Yes, I understand. Does it feel very bad?
Silence. And then a listless voice whispered,
no, it doesn't feel very bad. I just...
The voice faded out. Once more, only silence.
Maybe I'll see you again sometime,
Joe said. He knew it was the wrong thing to say. It horrified him to hear himself prattle out such an inanity. But it was the best he could do.
Let me put it another way,
he said, but he knew Al could no longer hear him.
I hope you feel better, he said. I'll check back after I tell them about the writing on the wall in there. I'll tell them not to come in here and look at it because it might...
He tried to think it out. To say it right.
They might bother you,
he finished. No response.
Well, so long,
Joe said, and left the darkness of the men's room. He walked unsteadily down the corridor, back to the conference room. Halting a moment, he took a deep, irregular breath, and then pushed open the conference room door. The TV set mounted in the far wall blared out a detergent commercial. On the great color 3D screen, a housewife critically examined a synthetic otter pelt towel, and in a penetrating, shrill voice declared it unfit to occupy a place in her bathroom. The screen then displayed her bathroom, and picked up graffiti on her bathroom wall, too. The same familiar scrawl, this time reading, "Lean over the bowl, and then take a dive. All of you are dead. I am alive." Only one person in the big conference room watched, however. Joe stood alone in an otherwise empty room. The others, the entire group of them, had gone. He wondered where they were, and if he would live long enough to find them. It did not seem likely. 10.
Has perspiration odor taken you out of the swim? 10-day Ubik deodorant spray, or Ubik roll-on, ends worry of offending. Brings you back where the happening is. Safe, when used as directed, in a conscientious program of body hygiene.
The television announcer said, "And now back to Jim Hunter and the news." On the screen, the sunny, hairless face of the newscaster appeared.
Glenn Runciter came back today to the place of his birth, but it was not the kind of return which gladdened anyone's heart. Yesterday, tragedy struck at Runciter Associates, probably the best known of Earth's many prudence organizations. In a terrorist blast at an undisclosed subsurface installation on Luna, Glenn Runciter was mortally wounded and died before his remains could be transferred to Cold Pack. Brought to the beloved Brethren Moratorium in Zurich, every effort was made to revive Runciter to half-life, but in vain. In acknowledgement of defeat, these efforts have now ceased, and the body of Glenn Runciter has been returned here to Des Moines, where it will lie in state at the Simple Shepherd Mortuary.
The screen showed an old-fashioned white wooden building with various persons roaming about outside.
"I wonder who authorized the transfer to Des Moines," Joe Chip said to himself.
"It was the sad but inexorably dictated decision by the wife of Glenn Runciter," the newscaster's voice continued, "which brought about this final chapter which we are now viewing. Mrs. Ella Runciter, herself in Cold Pack, whom it had been hoped her husband would join, revived to face this calamity. Mrs. Runciter learned this morning of the fate which had overtaken her husband, and gave the decision to abandon efforts to awaken belated half-life in the man whom she had expected to merge with, a hope disappointed by reality."
A still photo of Ella, taken during her lifetime, appeared briefly on the TV screen.
"In solemn ritual," the newscaster continued, "grieving employees of Runciter Associates assembled in the chapel of the Simple Shepherd Mortuary, preparing themselves as best they could, under the circumstances, to pay last respects."
The screen now showed the roof field of the mortuary. A parked, upended ship opened its hatch, and men and women emerged. A microphone, extended by newsmen, halted them.
"Tell me, sir," a newsmanish voice said. "In addition to working for Glenn Runciter, did you and these other employees also know him personally? Know him not as a boss, but as a man?"
Blinking like a light-blinded owl, Don Denny said into the extended microphone,
"We all knew Glenn Runciter as a man, as a good individual and a citizen whom we could trust. I know I speak for the others when I say this."
"Are all of Mr. Runciter's employees, or perhaps I should say former employees, here, Mr. Denny?"
"Many of us are here," Don Denny said. "Mr. Len Niggleman, a Prudence Society chairman, approached us in New York and informed us that he had heard of Glenn Runciter's death. He informed us that the body of the deceased was being brought here to Des Moines, and he said we ought to come here, and we agreed, so he brought us in his ship. This is his ship."
Denny indicated the ship out of which he and the others had stepped.
"We appreciated him notifying us of the change of location from the moratorium in Zurich to the mortuary here. Several of us are not here, however, because they weren't at the firm's New York offices. I refer in particular to Inertial's Al Hammond and Wendy Wright and the firm's field tester, Mr. Chip. The whereabouts of the three of them is unknown to us. But perhaps along with..."
"Yes,"
the news announcer with the microphone said.
"Perhaps they will see this telecast, which is being beamed by satellite over all of Earth, and will come here to Des Moines for this tragic occasion. As I am sure, and as you undoubtedly are sure, Mr. Runciter and also Mrs. Runciter would want them to. And now back to Jim Hunter at Newsroom Central."
Jim Hunter, reappearing on the screen, said,
"Ray Hollis,
whose psionically talented personnel are the object of inertial nullification and hence the target of the prudence organizations, said today in a statement released by his office that he regretted the accidental death of Glenn Runciter and would, if possible, attend the funeral services in Des Moines. It may be, however, that Len Nigelman, representing the Prudence Society, as we told you earlier, will ask that he be barred in view of the implication on the part of some Prudence Organization spokesman that Hollis originally reacted to news of Runciter's death with ill-disguised relief. Newscaster Hunter paused, picked up a sheet of paper, and said, "Turning now to other news." With his foot, Joe Chip tripped the pedal which controlled the TV set. The screen faded, and the sound ebbed into silence.
"This doesn't fit in with the graffiti on the bathroom walls," Joe reflected. "Maybe Runciter is dead after all. The TV people think so. Ray Hollis thinks so. So does Len Nigelman. They all consider him dead. And all we have that says otherwise is the two rhymed couplets, which could have been scrawled by anyone, despite what Al thought."
The TV screen relit. Much to his surprise, he had not repressed the pedal switch. And in addition, it changed channels. Images flitted past, of one thing and then another, until at last the mysterious agency was satisfied. The final image remained. The face of Glenn Runciter.
"Tired of lazy taste buds?"
Runciter said in his familiar, gravelly voice.
"Has boiled cabbage taken over your world of food? That same old, stale, flat, Monday morning odor, no matter how many dimes you put into your stove. Ubik changes all that. Ubik wakes up food flavor, puts hearty taste back where it belongs, and restores fine food smell."
On the screen, a brightly colored spray can replaced Glenn Runciter.
"One invisible puff, puff, whisk of economically priced Ubik banishes compulsive, obsessive fears that the entire world is turning into clotted milk, worn-out tape recorders, and obsolete iron cage elevators, plus other further, as yet unglimpsed, manifestations of decay. You see, world deterioration of this regressive type is a normal experience of many half-lifers, especially in the early stages when ties to the real reality are still very strong. A sort of lingering universe is retained as a residual charge, experienced as a pseudo-environment, but highly unstable and unsupported by any ergic substructure. This is particularly true when several memory systems are fused, as in the case of you people. But with today's new, more powerful than ever Ubik, all this is changed!"
Dazed, Joe seated himself, his eyes fixed on the screen. A cartoon fairy zipped airily in spirals, squirting Ubik here and there. A hard-eyed housewife with big teeth and horse's chin replaced the cartoon fairy. In a brassy voice, she bellowed,
"I came over to Ubik after trying weak, out-of-date reality supports. My pots and pans were turning into heaps of rust. The floors of my conapt were sagging. My husband, Charlie, put his foot right through the bedroom door. But now I use economical, new, powerful today's Ubik, and with miraculous results. Look at this refrigerator!"
On the screen appeared an antique, turret-top GE refrigerator.
"Why, it's devolved back 80 years!
62 years, Joe corrected reflexively.
"But now look at it!"
The housewife continued, squirting the old turret top with her spray can of Ubik. Sparkles of magic light lit up in a nimbus surrounding the old turret top, and, in a flash, a modern six-door pay refrigerator replaced it in splendid glory.
"Yes,"
Runciter's dark voice resumed.
"By making use of the most advanced techniques of present-day science, the reversion of matter to earlier forms can be reversed, and at a price any conapt owner can afford.
Ubik is sold by leading home art stores throughout Earth. Do not take internally. Keep away from open flame. Do not deviate from printed procedural approaches as expressed on label. So look for it, Joe. Don't just sit there. Go out and buy a can of Ubik and spray it all around you, night and day.
Standing up, Joe said loudly,
You know I'm here. Does that mean you can hear and see me?
Of course I can't hear you and see you. This commercial message is on videotape. I recorded it 2 weeks ago, specifically 12 days before my death. I knew the bomb blast was coming. I made use of precog talents.
Then you are really dead.
Of course I'm dead. Didn't you watch the telecast from Des Moines just now? I know you did, because my precog saw that too.
What about the graffiti on the men's room wall? Runciter, from the audio system of the TV set, boomed.
Another deterioration phenomenon. Go buy a can of Ubik, and it'll stop happening to you. All those things will cease.
Al thinks we're dead, Joe said.
Al is deteriorating.
Runciter laughed, a deep, re-echoing pulsation that made the conference room vibrate.
Look, Joe, I recorded this goddamn TV commercial to assist you, to guide you, you in particular, because we've always been friends. And I knew you'd be very confused, which is exactly what you are right now. Totally confused, which isn't very surprising considering your usual condition. Anyhow, try to hang on. Maybe once you get to Des Moines and see my body lying in state, you'll calm down.
What's this Ubik? Joe asked.
I think, though, it's too late to help Al,
Joe said.
What is Ubik made of? How does it work?
As a matter of fact, Al probably induced the writing on the men's room wall. You wouldn't have seen it except for him.
You really are on videotape, aren't you? Joe said. You can't hear me. It's true. Runciter said.
And in addition, Al...
Rats!
Joe said in weary disgust. It was no use. He gave up. The horse-jawed housewife returned to the TV screen, winding up the commercial. Her voice softer now, she trilled,
If the home art store that you patronize doesn't yet carry Ubik, return to your Conapt, Mr. Chip, and you'll find a free sample has arrived by mail. A free introductory sample, Mr. Chip, that will keep you going until you can buy a regular size can.
She then faded out. The TV set became opaque and silent. The process that had turned it on had turned it back off.
So I'm supposed to blame Al, Joe thought.
The idea did not appeal to him. He sensed the peculiarity of the logic. It's perhaps deliberate misdirectedness. Al, the fall guy. Al made into the patsy. Everything explained in terms of Al.
Senseless, he said to himself.
And had Runciter been able to hear him? Had Runciter only pretended to be on videotape? For a time, during the commercial, Runciter had seemed to respond to his questions. Only at the end had Runciter's words become malappropriate. He felt all at once like an ineffectual moth fluttering at the windowpane of reality, dimly seeing it from outside. A new thought struck him, an eerie idea. Suppose Runciter had made the videotape recording under the assumption, based on inaccurate precog information, that the bomb blast would kill him and leave the rest of them alive. The tape had been made honestly, but mistakenly. Runciter had not died. They had died, as the graffiti on the men's room wall had said, and Runciter still lived. Before the bomb blast, he had given instructions for the taped commercial to be played at this time, and the network had done so, Runciter having failed to countermand his original order. That would explain the disparity between what Runciter had said on the tape and what he had written on the bathroom walls. It would, in fact, explain both, which, as far as he could make out, no other explanation would. Unless Runciter was playing a sardonic game with them, trifling with them, first leading them in one direction, then the other. An unnatural and gigantic force, haunting their lives, emanating either within the living world or the half-life world. Or, he thought suddenly, perhaps both. In any case, controlling what they experienced, or at least a major part of it. Perhaps not the decay, he decided. Not that. But why not? Maybe, he thought, that too. But Runciter wouldn't admit it. Runciter and Yubik. Ubiquity, he realized all at once. That's the derivation of the made-up word, the name of Runciter's alleged spray can product, which probably did not even exist. It was probably a further hoax, to bewilder them that much more. And, in addition, if Runciter were alive, then not one but two Runciters existed. The genuine one in the real world who was striving to reach them, and the phantasmagoric Runciter who had become a corpse in this half-life world, the body lying in state in Des Moines, Iowa. And, to carry the logic of this out to its full extent, other persons here, such as Ray Hollis and Len Nigelman, were also phantasmagoria, while their authentic counterparts remained in the world of the living.
Very confusing, Joe Chip said to himself.
He did not like it at all. Granted, it had a satisfying symmetrical quality, but on the other hand, it struck him as untidy.
I'll zip over to my ConApp, he decided, pick up the free sample of Yubik, then head for Des Moines. After all, that's what the TV commercial urged me to do. I'll be safer carrying a can of Yubik with me, as the ad pointed out in its own jingly, clever way. One has to pay attention to such admonitions, he realized, if one expects to stay alive, or half alive, whichever it is.
The taxi led him off on the roof field of his ConApp building. He descended by moving ramp and arrived at his own door. With a coin that someone had given him, Al or Pat, he could not knowingly remember, he opened the door and entered. The living room smelled faintly of burned grease, an odor he had not come across since childhood. Going into the kitchen, he discovered the reason. His stove had reverted, back to an ancient Buck natural gas model with clogged burners and encrusted oven door which did not close entirely. He gazed at the old, much-used stove dully, then discovered that the other kitchen appliances had undergone similar metamorphoses. The homeopate machine had vanished entirely. The toaster had dissolved sometime during the day and reformed itself as a rubbishy, quaint, non-automatic model. Not even pop-up, he discovered as he poked bleakly at it. The refrigerator that greeted him was an enormous belt-driven model, a relic that had floated into being from God knew what distant past. It was even more obsolete than the turret-top GE shown in the TV commercial. The coffee pot had undergone the least change. As a matter of fact, in one respect, it had improved. It lacked the coin slot, operating obviously toll-free. This aspect was true of all the appliances, he realized. All that remained, anyhow. Like the homeopate machine, the garbage disposal unit had entirely vanished. He tried to remember what other appliances he had owned, but already memory had become vague. He gave up and returned to the living room. The TV set had receded back a long way. He found himself confronted by a dark wood cabinet, Atwater Kent, tuned radio-frequency old-time AM radio, complete with antenna and ground wires. God in heaven, he said to himself, appalled. But why hadn't the TV set reverted instead to formless metals and plastics? Those, after all, were its constituents. It had been constructed out of them, not out of an earlier radio. Perhaps this weirdly verified a discarded ancient philosophy, that of Plato's ideal objects, the universals which, in each class, were real.
The form TV set had been a template imposed as a successor to other templates, like the procession of frames in a movie sequence.
Prior forms, he reflected, must carry on an invisible, residual life in every object. The past is latent, is submerged, but still there, capable of rising to the surface once the later imprinting, unfortunately and against ordinary experience, vanished. The man contains not the boy, but earlier men, he thought. History began a long time ago. The dehydrated remnants of Wendy, the procession of forms that normally takes place, that procession ceased. And the last form wore off, with nothing subsequent, no newer form, no next stage of what we see as growth to take its place. This must be what we experience as old age. From this absence comes degeneration and senility. Only in this instance, it happened abruptly, in a matter of hours. But this old theory, didn't Plato think that something survived the decline? Something inner, not able to decay? The ancient dualism, body separated from soul, the body ending as Wendy did, and the soul, out of its nest, the bird, flown elsewhere. Maybe so, he thought. To be reborn again, as the Tibetan Book of the Dead says. It really is true. Christ, I hope so. Because in that case, we all can meet again. In, as in Winnie the Pooh, another part of the forest, where a boy and his bear will always be playing. A category, he thought, imperishable, like all of us. We will all wind up with poo in a cleaner, more durable, new place.
For curiosity's sake, he turned on the prehistoric radio set. The yellow celluloid dial glowed. The set gave off a loud 60-cycle hum, and then, amid static and squeals, a station came on.
Time for Pepper Young's family,
the announcer said, and organ music gurgled.
Brought to you by Mild Kamei, the soap of beautiful women. Yesterday, Pepper discovered that the labor of months had come to an unexpected end, due to the...
Joe shut the radio off at that point.
A pre-World War II soap opera,
he said to himself, marveling.
Well, it followed the logic of the form reversions taking place in this, the dying half-world, or whatever it was.
Looking around the living room, he discovered a baroque-legged, glass-top coffee table on which a copy of Liberty magazine rested. Also pre-World War II, the magazine featured a serial entitled Lightning in the Night, a futuristic fantasy supposing an atomic war. He turned the pages numbly, then studied the room as a whole, seeking to identify other changes. The tough, neutral-colored floor had become wide, softwood boards. In the center of the room, a faded Turkish rug lay, impregnated with years of dust. One single picture remained on the wall, a glass-covered framed print in monochrome showing a dying Indian on horseback. He had never seen it before. It stirred no memories, and he did not care for it one bit. The vidphone had been replaced by a black hook-style upright telephone, pre-dial. He lifted the receiver from the hook and heard a female voice saying,
"Number, please."
At that, he hung up. The thermostatistically controlled heating system had evidently departed. At one end of the living room, he perceived a gas heater, complete with large tin flue running up the wall almost to the ceiling. Going into the bedroom, he looked in the closet, rummaged, then assembled an outfit, black oxfords, wool socks, knickers, blue cotton shirt, camel's hair sports coat, and golf cap. For more formal wear, he laid out on the bed a pinstripe blue-black double-breasted suit, suspenders, wide floral necktie, and white shirt with celluloid collar.
Jeez,
he said to himself in dismay, as, in the closet, he came across a golf bag with assorted clubs.
What a relic!
Once more he returned to the living room. This time he noticed the spot where his polyphonic audio components had formerly been assembled. The multiplex FM tuner, the high hysteresis turntable and weightless tracking arm, Speakers, horns, multi-track amplifier, all had vanished. In their place, a tall, tan, wooden structure greeted him. He made out the crank handle and did not need to lift the lid to know what his sound system now consisted of. Bamboo needles, a pack of them on the bookcase beside the Victrola, and a 10-inch, 78-speed black label Victor record of Ray Noble's orchestra playing Turkish Delight. So much for his tape and LP collection. And by tomorrow, he would probably find himself equipped with a cylinder phonograph, screw-driven, and, to play on it, a shouted recitation of the Lord's Prayer. A fresh-looking newspaper lying at the far end of the overstuffed sofa attracted his attention. He picked it up and read the date. Tuesday, September 12th, 1939. He scanned the headlines. French claims Siegfried Line dented. Report gains in area near Saarbrücken. Major battle said to be shaping up along Western Front.
Interesting, he said to himself.
World War II had just begun, and the French thought they were winning it. He read another headline. Polish report claims German forces halted, say invaders throw new forces into battle without new gains. The newspaper had cost 3 cents. That interested him, too.
What could you get now for 3 cents?
He asked himself. He tossed the newspaper back down and marveled once again at its freshness. A day or so old, he guessed. No more than that.
So, I now have a time fix. I know precisely how far back the regression is carried.
Wandering about the Connaught, searching out the various changes, he found himself facing a chest of dresser drawers in the bedroom. On the top rested several framed, glass-covered photographs. All were of Runciter, but not the Runciter he knew. These were of a baby, a small boy, then a young man. Runciter as he once had been, but still recognizable. Getting out his wallet, he found only snapshots of Runciter. None of his family, none of his friends. Runciter everywhere. He returned the wallet to his pocket, then realized with a jolt that it had been made of natural cowhide, not plastic. Well, that fitted. In the old days, there had been organic leather available.
So what? He said to himself.
Bringing the wallet out once more, he somberly scrutinized it. He rubbed the cowhide and experienced a new tactile sensation, a pleasant one.
Infinitely superior to plastic,
he decided. Back in the living room again, he poked about, searching for the familiar mail slot, the recessed wall cavity which should have contained today's mail. It had vanished. It no longer existed. He pondered, trying to envision old-time mail practices. On the floor outside the Connap door? No. In a box of some kind? He recalled the term mailbox.
Okay, it would be in the mailbox, but where had mailboxes been located? At the main entrance of the building?
That dimly seemed right. He would have to leave his Connapt. The mail would be found on the ground floor, 20 stories below.
5 cents, please,
his front door said when he tried to open it. One thing, anyhow, hadn't changed. The toll door had an innate stubbornness to it. Probably it would hold out after everything else. After everything except it had long since reverted, perhaps in the whole city, if not the whole world. He paid the door a nickel, hurried down the hall to the moving ramp which he had used only minutes ago. The ramp, however, had now reverted to a flight of inert concrete stairs.
20 flights down,
he reflected. Step by step. Impossible. No one could walk down that many stairs. The elevator. He started toward it, then remembered what had happened to Al.
Suppose this time I see what he saw, he said to himself. An old iron cage hanging from a wire cable, operated by a senile borderline moron wearing an official elevator operator's cap. Not a vision of 1939, but a vision of 1909. A regression much greater than anything I've run into so far. Better not to risk it. Better to take the stairs.
Resigned, he began to descend. He had gotten almost halfway down when something ominous flicked alive in his brain.
There was no way by which he could get back up, either to his Conapt or to the roof field where the taxi waited. Once on the ground floor, he would be confined there, maybe forever. Unless the spray can of Ubik was potent enough to restore the elevator or the moving ramp. Surface travel, he said to himself.
What the hell will that consist of by the time I get down there? Train? Covered wagon?